The fourth case of the morning is number 044238, Surratt against the Chicago Transit Authority. Mr. Flaxman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, this is a sex discrimination case. Mrs. Surratt works for the CTA. In 2001, she asked to be accommodated about job stress that she feared she faced when she came back to work. The CTA ended up not letting her come back to work and putting her in what's called Area 605. The CTA moved for summary judgment in the district court, asserting that plaintiff could not establish two of the four McDonnell-Douglas prima facie case elements, that there was not an adverse employment action, and that the plaintiff could not establish that there was a similarly situated male. District judge correctly concluded that putting someone in this area 605 where you are not guaranteed a return to your job, where after 6 months you're at half pay, is an adverse employment action. That was correct. The district judge was also correct in concluding that plaintiff's evidence viewed in the summary judgment standard established that there was a similarly situated male. There was a Mr. Porterfield who had been off for 4 months, who was put in Area 605 at the same time plaintiff was put in. Plaintiff, though, had only been off work for 1 month, and she had been, the CTA policy was you have to be off for 60 days before you get put into Area 605.
Was there a regulation that created that 60-day rule?
There was a policy.
A written policy?
I'm not sure whether it was written, but it was admitted, but that it's our rule is 60 days. And they said we deviated from that rule in this case because we were concerned about overtime, excessive overtime if people were unable to work. And That was their explanation for deviating.
Was there any evidence in the record as to where that, for the basis of that deviation? Was that a deviation simply in this case, or was that a change in policy toward a particular group of workers? What does the record show?
Viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, it shows it was created just for her and just created basically in summary judgment proceedings. When the supervisor was deposed, he didn't...
And viewed in light most favorable to the defendant, what does it show?
To the defendant?
Yeah.
I mean, to the plaintiff, where...
No, to the defendant, what does it show?
I don't think it shows anything, because they just have one man saying that this is why I did it. He didn't say it at his deposition. He said it in a post-deposition affidavit that was submitted for summary judgment, affidavit prepared just for litigation. I didn't see any documentation saying
does
we have...
Does it contradict an earlier deposition?
The deposition was taken before summary judgment.
You said there was an affidavit.
Affidavit was filed after... The deposition was taken,
yes,
and was prepared for summary judgment purposes, in which he had this new reason. Well, I had this conversation at some point with my supervisor who said we have to be concerned about overtime. There was no documentation that I recall on the record that...
So we had a deposition and an affidavit from this individual?
That's correct.
Does the affidavit contradict the deposition?
It added new facts.
Thank you.
And I would say it contradicted because he was asked, what are the reasons in the deposition? And then in the affidavit, he thought of more reasons. So I would say that's a contradiction. And I'm sure the defense will say it's not a contradiction. It's just explaining. The real troubling point in this appeal is there was no admissible evidence presented by the defendants to show why they put her in Area 605. The CTA doctor examined Mrs. Surratt and said that she was dizzy. And Mrs. Surratt said, I never told them I was dizzy. I never complained about that. 8 days later, another CTA doctor said, oh, well, she has bronchitis. She can't come back to work. The Area 605 committee said, well, she's going to be off work because of hypertension and diabetes. There's no document that was part of this record that I believe exists that supports that diagnosis that was made by this committee. There's also nothing that was before the committee that said that she's going to be off work for any extended period of time. We don't have an explanation for that. I'd like to hear what the defendants say when they get up and try to explain that. They did not respond to that, I believe, in their answering brief. I think we pointed that out in the reply brief. And this is a case that should have gone to trial.
Thank you, Mr. Flaxman. We'll hear now from Ms. Kaplan. Ms. Kaplan, perhaps you could address yourself to this question of the 60 days and the deviation from this 60-day policy. What is the basis of the 60-day policy? What is the basis of the deviation? Was it just in this case, or was it more general applicability?
Certainly, Your Honor. To begin with, in response to your question as to whether or not there was a deviation from the policy only in this case, the answer is no. First of all, the CTA's policy regarding placement in Area 605 is, in fact, a written policy. And this policy was modified as it related to employees in the facilities maintenance department of the CTA by a directive issued by a manager named John Hunter. In late February or early March, Mr. Hunter issued a directive stating that if an employee is out for 30 days and the return to work date is uncertain, then they should be recommended for placement in Area 605. And the reason behind this was because the CTA was concerned about overtime costs and the excessive expenses that they were paying due to overtime costs. And as long as a rail janitor coordinator position was open, such as plaintiffs, and it was filled by a person with less seniority, such as a rail janitor pool coordinator, the CTA had to pay overtime to that person. So the CTA wanted to ensure that if someone was going to be gone for a certain amount of time, that position was in fact replaced, that a person was filling that position, and so it could avoid paying these extensive overtime costs.
This amendment to the 60-day policy, this directive of Mr. Hunter's, was that simply an oral directive, or was it in writing?
It was an oral directive, Your Honor, and it was communicated in meetings he had with the people that he supervised.
And how do we know about that oral amendment in terms of the record in this case? How did it get into the case?
Because he testified to it when he was deposed in this case, and it's also included in an affidavit that was provided by Mark Bonk, who received that directive and subsequently recommended plaintiff for placement in Area 605.
Now, counsel for the plaintiff has suggested to us that there is, in fact, a contradiction between Mr. Hunter's deposition and his affidavit. Could we have your perspective on that, please?
I think plaintiff's counsel may have said that there's a contradiction in Mark Bonk's deposition and Mark Bonk's affidavit. Mr. Bonk was the immediate supervisor of the plaintiff in this case, and he did have a deposition in this case. And in his deposition, he mentioned as the reasons for plaintiff's placement in Area 605 that those reasons were related to the fact that the CTA wouldn't have to pay overtime to a rail pool janitor coordinator working in plaintiff's position. And he also testified that Hunter continually discussed ways to eliminate overtime. The fact that he did not specifically mention Hunter's directive as a reason why he recommended plaintiff for Area 605 is immaterial. The clear fact was that the reason that that plaintiff was recommended for Area 605 was because of overtime concerns, and this was also underlined in Mark Bonk's letter to the Disability Review Committee, which was the final decision maker in this case. That was a committee that determined that plaintiff would actually be placed in Area 605. Bonk merely recommended that plaintiff would be placed in Area 605. And because Bonk consistently identified overtime concerns as the reason for plaintiff's recommendation to Area 605, the lack of a specific reference to Hunter's directive is insignificant here, Your Honor. The CTA asserts that plaintiff did not meet her prima facie case in this instance because she didn't prove that she suffered from an adverse employment action or that a similarly situated male was treated better. However, even if this court finds that she did meet her prima facie case, plaintiff's failure to demonstrate that the CTA's conduct in placing her in Area 605 was pretextual dooms her case. Because the Disability Review Committee was the final decision maker in placing plaintiff in Area 605, plaintiff would need to show that it had discriminatory animus towards her based on her gender. But plaintiff has never asserted this on appeal, nor has she responded in any way to this argument. Plaintiff has not shown that the CTA's reasons for placing her in Area 605 were not because of her medical condition or were not because of her overtime concerns. Plaintiff asserts that there are three bases here for pretext, but none of these are convincing. Plaintiff first asserts that she believed she could return to work, but it is the CTA's doctors who are medically qualified to make that determination, not plaintiff, who is a layperson.
There is a hint, I think, in the plaintiff's argument that the physicians employed by the CTA are in cahoots with management and are simply supplying the appropriate documentation. Could we have your perspective on that?
Your Honor, the actors in this case, the alleged bad actors, according to plaintiff, did not act in cahoots or in conspiracy or anything of that nature. In this instance, Mark Bonk was plaintiff's immediate supervisor. Mark Bonk made the recommendation to the Disability Review Committee that plaintiff be placed in Area 605. He was not the final decision maker. Plaintiff has never asserted that the Disability Review Committee rubber-stamped Bonk's recommendation. Mr. Bonk had no involvement in determining whether plaintiff was medically able to do her job. Mr. Bonk had no decision-making authority relative to how long the CTA's medical department would decide the plaintiff was medically unfit. So while there might be a whiff of an assertion, plaintiff has provided absolutely no proof demonstrating that there was anything like a conspiracy among the actors here. And I'd also just like to note that plaintiff has waived any argument on appeal other than issues relating to her placement in Area 605. Plaintiff herself acknowledges as much in her opening brief, where she says that the primary reasons or the primary issue on appeal is her placement in Area 605. So this court need not examine how long plaintiff stayed in Area 605 or when she was returned to her position. If there are no further questions, the CTA respectfully requests that this court affirm the lower court's decision granting its summary judgment.
Thank you, Ms. Kaplan.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes, Mr. Flaxman.
We just heard that the policy was changed from 60 days to 30 days, but we haven't heard why it was applied after 27 days to the plaintiff. She was ready to she was off work from March 1st. On March 28th, Mr. Bach made the recommendation that she should be put into Area 605. We also haven't heard.
When was that effective, that she was in 605? I understand he made the recommendation. Was that effective as of a certain date?
April 5th is when the committee met.
So then.
It was after 30 days.
So it was after 30.
Right.
I just wanted to
but,
get that
but
clarified.
He made his recommendation in less than 30 days, and he also made his recommendation without anything
so,
that's.
So, yeah, he made his recommendation less than 30 days, but the committee acted after 30 days.
That's correct. But the question that I would ask a jury is, why did he think she couldn't come back to work then or next week or 30 days from now? Where's the doctor's note saying she's sick, she needs more treatment? Where's the even the CTA doctor saying she's medically unable to come back to work? There isn't anything. There's the CTA doctor saw her in the beginning of March, March 1st, and I think then March 9th. And then we have this finding by the Disability Review Committee based on no evidence that's been submitted other than counsel's arguments about they don't discriminate, saying that she's medically unable to come back to work. That is not, I think, what the Supreme Court was talking about when they talked about you need admissible evidence to articulate a reason for a legitimate business reason for the disparate treatment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flaxman. The case will be taken under advisement with our thanks to both counsel.